from the kickoff for Bayfield and Bloom. Larry Mueller here with a bit of a cold, but thank you for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We are back for the 17th year to celebrate spring on the shores of Lake Superior. And you know, hear that applause. We have a packed house here. Wonderful Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. And it's great to have all of them with me today. And great to have you listening in. And great to have the guests that we have for you today. Gardening's been a little rough this spring, but we have a panel of experts to help you out and answer your questions. Back with us once again, Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Jason, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry. Did you say spring? What's that?
Yeah, spring. In case you weren't looking at the weather, we have 7 or 8 inches of snow.
We mixed it up for you this year, daffodils with snow. You like that?
Well, you know what? In southern Wisconsin, our daffodils were a week or two early, and we had 7 or 8 inches of snow down there a week or two ago. So I'm sure snow is going to be a topic for some of the questions we get today. Don Kissinger back with us once again. Don, good to see you.
Thank you. It's always great to come to my most northern Tree City USA community in Bayfield, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, Don, he is the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and he's been doing this pretty much since we started, I think, almost.
I think you're right.
And but we've got a first-timer, too, Tom Casper. Tom owns Bending Birches Greenhouse, located near Duluth, Minnesota. Tom, welcome.
Well, it's great to be here for the first time, and certainly, if folks heard, we got lots of snow in Duluth, and the radio stations were playing Christmas music 2 days ago. So it's nice to see the sunshine.
So as we move along here today, what questions do you have for our experts? You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, audience members, feel free to raise your hand, and we will. Jill Nadeau, our producer, is here with a microphone, and she can get to you. Let's go to Tom first. Tell us a little bit about your history, horticulture history, and some of the areas you focus on.
Right on the spot. I like that. Well, I've been in Duluth since 1991, originally from Bismarck, North Dakota, and graduated from North Dakota State University with a degree. Hey, another bison! We're everywhere. With a degree in horticulture, and prior to owning my own greenhouse, I managed the maintenance of the park system for the city of Duluth, places like the Rose Garden, Inger Park, and Bayfront, and the Lake Walk, stuff like that, and did lots of flowers and planning of landscapes and implementing ideas. And now own a greenhouse, actually with my son, which is a great opportunity for me to spend time with one of my adult sons. Sure. Daily. So it's been a lot of fun and a lot of learning. Our greenhouses are all organic and using compostable containers and no pesticides and stuff. So really committed to the environment as well.
It's wonderful, and it's great to have you here, hopefully as a regular guest.
Sounds great to me.
On the program. Well, gentlemen, we that snow, I'm sure Don Kissinger probably has some comments because of the very wet snow. And talking to some of the folks here today, branches were torn off. There was some damage.
Yeah, I guess the big concern is the smaller trees, and if we get a lot of weight on those and limb breakage. As I was saying, I'm going to be having a Tree City Arbor Day celebration this afternoon, and of the 10 I think I've done so far, I've only had one when it's been dry weather. So I've had knee boots in muck, and yesterday I was in Washburn in muck as well. But the big thing is with the weight of the snow on these limbs and the breakage that'll cause.
Yeah, and Jason Fishbach, what about the other plants?
Well, luckily up here nothing's growing anyway, so we don't have a lot of leaf material out. But the main concern would be the evergreens that hold up that heavy snow. I did see most of the daffodils are flattened, but I would guess by the end of today they'll have stood right back up.
You did see some rodent damage, did you not, from the your trees and shrubs
up in this area? I've been up here for about 15 years, and I've never seen this level of damage to trees and shrubs, from metal voles chewing at the base of the stems and rabbits up in the canopy 5 feet up. That's how high some of our snowdrifts were. So it's bad. We've lost a lot of trees and shrubs, and we'll see what we won't see the full extent of the damage here for another week or two once the buds start pushing out, and then they're going to collapse, and everyone's going to be calling me, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah, then you'll be talking about it. You know, you think back, and you say, well, what could I have done?
Yeah, the only thing you can do, really, is protect the base of those plants. Now, shrubs are harder to do because there's so many stems, but for sure, wrapping. Now, usually we'll wrap, and we'll recommend wrapping the first couple of years, and then the bark gets thick enough to resist it, usually. But this was, we found 6-8-inch apple trees that are getting chewed on.
Whoa.
So they were hungry this year, and they chewed through that thick bark and through the cambium, and we're going to see a lot of tree mortality.
This is probably a good time, at this, at least in this part of the state, and probably anywhere in the state, Don, to do some pruning anyway. What do you think?
Well, I think pruning is fine, but once you start, the buds start to push out and leaves start forming, you kind of want to hold back. So basically, I like pruning midwinter or once the leaves are fully formed, pruning at that time of the year. However, the one caveat is with oak trees and oak wilt, I don't like to prune them at this time of the year. You want to hold off probably April through July. But, otherwise, when the leaves are fully formed, pruning is fine at that point in time.
Yeah. So somebody asked me, what does oak wilt look like? And I said, well, it looks like a dead tree after a certain amount of time. But
for the older folks, oak wilt looks just like Dutch elm trees, except on an oak tree, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
And what it does is it's a fungus, unlike with Dutch elm disease, and it's a fungus with that, but it starts with the beetle, and it can with the oak tree. But in theory, if a person never prunes a tree at the wrong time of the year, or if you don't have storm damage, you will never have oak wilt. Because once it starts in the tree, you start seeing flagging, which is yellowing from the branch tips down to the bottom of the tree. And the tough thing is that this fungus moves from tree to tree via root grafts. So you can have trees that are 50 feet away, 75 feet away, and you could still get this fungus.
Yeah, I had someone call Garden Talk here not long ago, and they had about 7 or 8 oak trees, and they'd had last year, they'd had them, somebody pruned them in the wrong time of the year, and now they're all going away.
Yep, the one way that you can take care of it if you have oak wilt in a tree is doing vibratory root graft barriers, is figuring out distance of that, the stem or the trunk of that tree and other oaks around there, and figuring out kind of a shoot in the dark where that fungus might be, and actually severing the roots between the healthy trees and the diseased trees. And there are some chemicals that you can use to kind of as a prophylactic to keep your healthy trees viable too.
One of the kind of the cool things about coming to the Bayfield Pavilion is that there are a lot of plants here that people can buy, and I'll talk about that a little bit more here coming up. But Tom, when it comes to, I'm sure every single one of your plants that you might sell is perfect. But what do people look, what should you be looking for?
Well, you're right, Larry, they are perfect. but what folks want to look for is if they're, when they're visiting a greenhouse or over at Paul's stand or any of the other folks that are selling plants here, really look for nice, healthy-looking plants without a lot of leaves, without a lot of damage to them. And I know it's hard for folks when they go to the greenhouse to look, but oftentimes look for plants that aren't blooming yet. Really, those annuals are better off putting on their growth in the greenhouse and under controlled conditions where they're fed properly and watered properly, and they're not blooming, so they've been pushed to bloom oftentimes. So look for the ones that aren't blooming and get those into your garden, really taking some time to acclimate them So putting them outside when it's warm and in the garage for a few days and slowly working them into the environment before you just take them out of the greenhouse and plant them right away. So looking for nice, healthy plants. And if nobody's around at the greenhouse, pop them out of the container.
If nobody's looking.
Nobody's looking. And look at those roots. You want to look for nice, fibrous, white, healthy-looking roots in the container. And then you know that they've been taken care of.
Yeah, very good tips. Let's take some calls. By the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dean in Red Cliff has something for us, so let's go there. Whoop, we lost Dean in Red Cliff. So let's go to Tony in Egg Harbor. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Morning, Larry. I have a question regarding now that trees are starting to bud, we'll start seeing more ash trees that have died off. And with all the millions of trees that we've lost because of the Asian ash borer, do CO2 levels and oxygen levels change because we don't have the photosynthesis because of the loss of the trees? And do carbon dioxide levels go up because we're not absorbing carbon?
That's a very good question, and I actually saw some information on that, and I can't remember it now off the top of my head. Don Kissinger, any comment?
I'm thinking that there is a change. To what extent, I don't know. Something peripheral to that, and I will make mention, is they have done some studies in areas where emerald ash borer has been and has killed a lot of trees, and they've seen that the death of ash trees has also correlated to people passing away at a higher level too. So it's the mental part of trees and how they affect you. So not only the physical, the oxygen that they do create, to what extent, is that affecting it? I mean, in Wisconsin, we have, through inventory analysis, over 700 million ash trees. And that's, your small fingerling size ones up to your, 40-inch ash trees. Minnesota is the only state that has more ash trees, and they have about 900 million. So it is going to affect us in some extent, and that's why one of the things that we're looking at in the DNR are trees that can take over for that in those areas. So I think that's a fact. To what extent? I don't think that there's been research, and maybe there's research going on, but there's no answers to that right at this point in time.
Yeah, Jason?
I was going to comment. There's some interesting dynamics that happen when you do have death in the canopy of a tree. So let's say you've got an older stand of ash and they die off. Well, depending on what's happening under the understory, you might actually have more carbon sequestration than you did with just the ash trees, because the plants that are growing the fastest, and that typically is what happens when you remove an overstory, all those seedlings underneath, maybe it's a different species, they grow really fast and they're accumulating a lot of carbon, versus an older stand, it's more or less carbon neutral at that point. The older wood is dying and off-gassing, and then that little bit of replacement new growth each year. So it, again, the overall effect across the globe is going to be almost immeasurable, but that is the something to consider when we do have this stand turnover, is we do have rapid growth that follows usually.
Well, we have more callers online, and I think we've got some eager members of the audience who have questions for us as well. But just a reminder, we're broadcasting today from the Bayfield Pavilion for Bayfield in Bloom to kick it off 17 years in a row now. Our guest today, Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Agriculture Agent from Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger, the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the DNR, and Tom Casper. Tom owns Bending Birches Greenhouse near Duluth, Minnesota. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion, getting close to my birthday, and it's always fun to be here for my birthday. The Ashland Bayfield County Master Gardeners always do a wonderful job. Joanne Collins from the group makes sure I have a birthday card, which is normally about 4 pages long. And it's just an absolutely beautiful card today. And they have a booth here as well at the Bayfield Pavilion. The Apostle Islands booksellers are here. I know Ben Goldfarb, who I had on my show a while back to talk about his book, Eager, his book about beavers. He's here. I know he's going to be speaking 2 o'clock this afternoon at the Apostle Islands booksellers in Bayfield. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And just to let you know, there's always lots going on in this part of the country. There's the Bayfield County Aquatic Invasive Species Organization. It's a great project. The DNR has its own, and they always have one every year, the Urban Forestry for North Central Wisconsin. Don was answering a lot of questions beforehand. Landmark Conservancy, and I've only named a couple of all of the groups that are here, and it's wonderful to have them all here and to let you know that, hey, even though it snowed 7 or so inches, there's still plenty to do in this part of the state. We have 3 great experts here to answer your questions, and we've got an audience. Audience members, if you have a question, raise your hand. We'll go to you. Otherwise, you can phone in at 1-800-642-1234. But if you're in the audience, don't phone. Just raise your hand. We'll get phone calls from others. As a matter of fact, Dan in Paloma has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Larry. Hey, congratulations on the 17th year. Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. My question is I have started tomatoes, and they're outgrowing their cups, and I want to go to like a 4-inch until I can put them in the ground. And there's a lot of blight in my area. And some of my pots, I don't believe, are contaminated by blight at all, but I'm wondering how I can sanitize them, if possible, to use them again.
All right. Tom, we'll start with you.
Sure. And that's a great question as folks are dealing with things like early blight and in their tomatoes. A couple of things he can do with the pots. One of them is the best thing is to wash them, and you can reuse them really in just some standard water with a tiny little bit of bleach in it and maybe a little bit of Dawn dish soap, just enough to sterilize the pot. Scrub it out with a hand scrubber, allow it to air dry, and that really should take care of the problem with blight in the container. Now, if he's dealt with it in his garden for several years, he may want to consider moving those tomatoes to somewhere else in the garden, preferably some distance away from where that problem has been, or taking a couple of years off from planting tomatoes in the garden if it's too small to be able to do that. And certainly as he's transplanting those plants into larger containers, he can plant them, because we're dealing with kind of a delayed spring here. And some of our plants, if you're growing them inside, might start getting a little bit leggy and a little bit out of control. He can plant those very deep, or even in a tomato's case, he can plant it on its side. It will continue to develop roots along that stem and still be a nice, sturdy plant when he's ready to put it out in the garden in a few weeks. So,
all right, there we go. Thank you so much for that question. Diane in Norwalk, it's your turn. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. I have just recently moved into a new home, and the landscaping has not been done yet. I'm wanting to plant something to attract and feed birds so that I can feed them at a feeder. I'm surrounded by a 5-acre field, and the nearest woods is behind that, so I don't have any trees at the present time. And I'm wondering about recommendations so that I can have some birds here sometime soon.
All right. Well, Jason, do you want to start?
Yeah, so number one is diversity. You want to offer as much different plant material as you can, and a good place to start would be with your shrubs that are producing berries. So viburnums, dogwoods, serviceberries, elderberries. And then you need some winter cover, ideally, for those birds. So putting out some evergreen shrubs, cedars, balsam, those types of plants will help give them some cover. And then things that attract insects, right? So all of your flowering plants that you can think of that work for your area bring the insects, and the insects bring the birds. So that's a good place to start. There's a lot of great books that are out there that talk about the way to improve the habitat on your property, I definitely recommend checking out some of those books and reading up before you get too far.
Yeah, thanks very much for that question. Let's take a question from the audience.
Oh, thanks. Hey, Larry. Gordy Ringberg. I'm the mayor here. First,
Ringberg.
Welcome back. We love having you guys here, you and your crew, and of course, everyone who comes to visit us here. You have some great advice. Don here and I are going to be doing a tree planting later today with the fourth graders from the school doing our Arbor Day celebration. So everyone who is here can join us with that. But I have a personal question. So I live up on the hill. I have a very shaded lot. And when I moved in, the previous owner had put a lot of chemicals on the lawn. And I don't like the chemicals. I don't want them running down the lake and down the hill into the lake. So I've kind of let it go, and I'm getting this beautiful cover of moss. But is there another ground cover that I could put in there in the shaded area that in the areas the moss isn't taking?
Tom, you've got your hand raised up here.
Gordy, thanks again for hosting this, and certainly a beautiful city, Bayfield. Been here for years and years during Bayfield in Bloom with some bus tours, and I've always enjoyed being here. But a question often folks are dealing with is how to maybe replace grass with something that requires a little more less maintenance, but is still beautiful and looks nice. There are some different choices. You can grow things like Japanese spurge or pachysandra, which is a beautiful ground cover. Very, very hardy for our area, northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin. It's a beautiful dark, dark green color, has some small white flowers. And surprisingly, it's also an evergreen. So it will keep in the event that we don't get a lot of snow or a lot of snow cover, you'll have a green lawn in, or what appears to be a green lawn in January and February. So that's a great choice. And to give you some idea of how long-lasting it is, there's some of it growing in, on the grounds of Glensheen Mansion in Duluth that has been there for over 100 years. So it's very hardy, very beautiful, easy to take care of, and easy to divide or add to the garden. So I would recommend looking for that, and you can buy it in just small individual plants. There's also some other natives. Crown Vetch also works good in a situation like that. So those would be a couple that I would recommend for a ground cover that you could replace the moss with. Also, if you are dealing with moss, but you want a lawn in that place, removing some of the shade, so lightening up the canopy of that tree, pruning at the right time of the year, depending on what you have in there, and then also improving your soil with something, components that are better drained. So generally, moss is an issue of shade and poorly drained soil. So.
Yeah, for sure. Jason, anything to add?
I was going to comment. There's a really great resource that isn't used much by the public and gardeners that I'll clue you in on. It's used by land managers extensively. It's a publication by John Kotar. Write this down. K-O-T-A-R, right? And he published what are called habitat types. And it's a really fascinating way to see what would have grown on your property prior to disturbance, if you will. And it's basically an assessment of where you are in the state, what kind of soils you have, what your exposure might be, your orientation to the sun. And it'll list specifically what native plants would grow in that specific habitat type. And it's a great way to get some tips on, you know, what species might grow here if I have a white pine overstory. What would grow underneath white pine? And then you can go look for those native plants, or you can look for improved varieties of those native species. And they've gone through some breeding to produce showier flowers or better foliage. So John Kotar's Habitat Types. It's a great resource if you can find it.
Oh, wonderful. And thanks for that, for the comments and the question. You can join in to raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll get you right away because I'm partial right now to people here in the audience. By the way, if you're listening in, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you by phone as well. But we have another guest from the audience.
Hi, Larry. I'm Diana from Bayfield, and I have a container garden at my house that I've tried to use plants. I've tried to grow plants that bees and butterflies will like. Sometimes I've purchased plants from our local big box store, and recently I read an article about their use of neonicotinoids, is that pronounced correctly? Which are toxic to bees and butterflies. My question is, are they required to indicate that they have used these chemicals, these box stores, and in this largely agricultural state where farmers heavily rely on pollinators, is there any legislation that will regulate or ban the use of these deadly chemicals?
Tom, we'll go to you.
I guess I can help. I know in Minnesota they have tried to get legislation that identifies that, and it has not passed. Some individual communities have adopted that policy where folks are supposed to identify, or growers are supposed to identify. So it's good. It's good that you're asking that. And neonicotinoids are very bad for bees. It really interrupts their ability to find their hives, and has helped a lot with the colony collapse that has occurred around the country. So it's a good question to ask, and I would guess many of our growers here that are part of this are not using it, but it's a good question to ask as you're going to places like that. But right now, I don't believe that there's any legislation that requires them to identify. I know some do out of voluntarily doing that, but a lot of them do not specifically identify. But it's a good question to ask when you go to those garden centers.
Tom brought along a book that was written by Pamela Fish Carlson called Emma Bee, and it's a book for children, for young children. It's beautifully illustrated, and it's the kind of thing you can't start educating folks early enough.
That's right. It's a great children's book, but it's also perfect for adults. It's really about not using pesticides and growing plants without the use of them because of the impact that it has on bees and other parts of our wildlife. So it's just out. Pam Carlson, if folks recognize the name, of course, is the host of Great Gardening in Duluth, that's on public television, and a bee lover and a recent garden enjoyer. Sorry, Pam.
All right, let's take another question from the audience, and then we'll go back to the phones.
Hi, I'm Cheryl from Superior. A few years ago, I went to a honeyberry workshop, and they were talking about how northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota has great land for honeyberries, and that is really unoccupied now by much but swamps or grass. And these berries aren't really particular about the soil type. And deer will browse a little bit, but if you plant clover between the paths or between the bushes, they're more interested in the clover. I was just wondering if apparently they think that there's a good opportunity for commercial production, and I'm just wondering if anybody has been looking into that.
Jason Fishbach?
Yeah, so there are two fruit crops that I think would be a great fit for northern Wisconsin. The honeyberry, for sure, and also the currants that are resistant to the white pine blister rust, right? And there are a lot of varieties. The only way that's going to happen is if you as consumers start asking for it and demanding it and eating it, right? Currants are really easy to grow. We all wish people would eat them, because then we'd grow a lot more for you. So that's really because, for example, honeyberry, there's tundra, there's borealis, there's some great varieties that will do well. They can be mechanized in terms of harvesting, so they can be grown at scale by commercial growers, they can be grown by homeowners. It's really the consumers have a lot of power in the world of horticulture based on your purchasing decisions, because everybody will respond. So if you're looking for these, what we call rare or uncommon fruits, then people will grow them. And there's a lot of varieties that are out there that, you know, are better suited than even, say, strawberries or raspberries, the ones that we're used to. Blueberry is a good example. This is a plant that, of course, grows wild in our region and does well on our sandy, acidic soils. And thankfully, people love blueberries, so we have a good blueberry industry here in Bayfield.
And honeyberries, what are they like? Would you eat them just by the handful?
You can eat them fresh. They don't look like a blueberry, but a blue color. And people say they taste similar. Some people say they taste better.
All right. Thank you very much for that comment. I want to give Donna in Milwaukee a chance to join in, and then we'll go back to the audience. Donna, hi.
Hi. I'm from Milwaukee. What would the between Creepy Charlie and the Violets, who would win in your yard? Yeah.
Well, that's a good one.
I love both.
Tom Casper, what about you?
Well, I think the bees would win. Both of them are wonderful bloomers at different parts of the season, so they. If Donna allows those to continue, the Creeping Charlie blooms early in the year for our early bee populations, and then the violets a little bit later in the year. So really, if she doesn't mind, and I think it's a cultural shift for us to not think of our lawns as requiring all of these pesticides and it to be this perfect lawn of green grass that you could go out and play football on or whatever you wanted to. And really look at it as an opportunity for us to attract and help some of those populations that might need our help, whether it's monarch butterflies or bees or whatever insects that can benefit from us not wiping those things out. So,
yeah, I can really speak from experience on the Creeping Charlie. It does flower very early. It's the only thing practically that was, you know, it was the first thing to flower pretty much in southern Wisconsin. So there we go. And I gave up on trying to control violets or Creeping Charlie. They look kind of nice in the yard once in a while. And if I get sick of it, I get my daughter out too. And we get on the lawn and we start, I make her go a half hour picking Creeping Charlie out of the lawn. And you'd be surprised at how much Creeping Charlie you can get out of the lawn just by sitting there on your hands and knees and picking it.
Now, Larry, have you taken it to the next step? Do you let your dandelions go?
I don't have very many dandelions, and I just let nature take its course on that. I haven't had a lot of dandelions, so at least in my yard. Maybe it's, well, I'm not sure what it is. We were talking about the tomatoes earlier. I was thinking, as you were talking about planting recommendations and so forth, I was thinking, well, I just stick mine in straw bales, so I don't have, if you've got an area that, where you've had some disease problems in the past, straw bales actually work pretty darn well for growing tomatoes, for sure.
And surprisingly easy to do, too, once you
get down. Yeah. Once you get the bales seasoned, you're in good shape. Well, let's take another audience question.
We're digging up a flower garden because there's been a lot of stuff that's come into it that is just from the surrounding area. It's next to our front door. And I'm wondering what's the best way to get rid of all the stuff that's there. I'm hesitant to use Roundup. I don't know how long it lasts. There'll be a lot of bees and butterflies and things like that, and hummingbirds because of the flowers. So is just digging it out deeply, which is what I'm trying to do, the best way to get rid of all the old stuff?
Tom, you want to take that?
I guess I'll take that one. Well, first of all, congratulations on putting a garden in and your concern for bees and butterflies in that process. There are some things you can do different than getting out the spray bottle and using Roundup or some other kind of glyphosate material that will kill everything. And one of them is exactly what you said, by hand, getting out and digging by hand. And certainly getting in touch with the earth as part of that is very, very enriching and spiritual, I think. And if you don't want to do that, there are a couple other things you can do. If folks have ever used a blowtorch, you can actually go in, not too close to your house, though, or car or lawnmower or anything like that. But you can use a torch and burn those weeds. It's going to burn the tops, part of the weed, so you will get a second flush. But if you do that, a couple of times, you can knock that down, and it's a lot of fun to do, too. Or you can use a product like horticultural grade vinegar mixed appropriately with water. You mix the vinegar with water, warm water, and salt, and you can spray your soil in moderation. Now, you don't want to affect the pH or the anything like that with the soil, but one application, and that vinegar solution will burn those weeds down in minutes. Certainly within a day or two, they will be almost gone. And it similarly will kill the tops, some of the bot or the roots, so you may have to reapply. But in moderation, you can do either of those or physically and control those weeds without getting the spray out and wondering if it's affecting you or the insects or animals around you.
There you go. Thank you so much for that question. Let's go back to the phones. John in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Love the show. I was listening probably about a month ago, and somebody said that they had a tree next to the house, a smaller tree, and it's where they couldn't rent something to dig it out. Well, I do this trick with just about every crack and whatever. I boil hot water and wait till it's like dry for like 2 weeks, and then I pour the hot water on there, and it actually kills everything in the cracks and small trees, you know, like maybe about 2 inches around or whatever. But I would advise somebody that's doing this that's new at it to wear long sleeves and long pants.
Yeah. You don't want to be splashing that up on your legs.
Yes. But, yeah.
So, well, thanks for that, John. Jason, have you heard of that? Does that work?
I wasn't quite sure I understood the question. So cracks and sidewalks?
You got plants growing up between the cracks, I think.
Yeah, yeah. John, yeah, so hot boiling water will fry the leaves. And now it may not kill a perennial because the root system's still there. But, yeah, it can be effective. Just like vinegar, it acts as essentially a burn down herbicide, if you will, and kills everything that it comes in contact with.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much. Let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Bob from Washburn, and I tried to plant some pachysandra and get it going in a shady area that I thought was appropriate about 20 years ago, and it took about 18 years before it really started to take off, and now it wants to grow in an area I don't want it to grow. Where did I go wrong?
I can answer that one. I like your patience, Bob.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things about pachysandra is it does take some time to establish, but if you plant it, enough of it, and really it's a matter of anything with spacing and where you're placing it. So the more you plant, the faster it will fill an area in. Pretty easy to control early in the spring, going in with a shovel and setting that boundary. Digging it out, adding it into maybe some of the areas where you want it, or sharing it at plant sales, things like that. So hopefully you're enjoying it now, though, after 18 years.
And let's take one more call from our question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Barb from Highbridge. In 2016, I was hit with the flood. I'm between the two washouts on 13, and I lost everything, including my well and my septic. So now, after 15 months, I had a well that they found a new well in my yard that's a flowing well, 50 gallons a minute, and the pipe is 4 feet above ground. You know, it's capped, but the water comes up under the cap and comes down into my yard, and now I have cacti starting to grow. And the only thing I can do is actually, like, put a small ditch in, heading it towards the backfield because I'm on 35 acres. But I need to know what kind of wet plants or whatever can I put in there so it doesn't look like the mess it's looking now.
Oh, yeah. There's some really good opportunities, I think. Jason, you want to talk about that?
Well, you're in luck. So basically you've created someone's created for you a rain garden. Exactly. So there's some...
Yeah.
Great publications out there that can give you some species, but I'll rattle off a couple of Joe Pieweed, Wild Bergamot, Blue Flag Iris are some good options. But, you know, you meet with the nursery and say, this is the situation. I've got all this water
and they'll quickly have a list of plants for you, all of which are native, and a lot of these wetland or wet adapted native species produce really showy flowers too, and are really great at attracting bees and butterflies. So you really can't go wrong in that situation.
And I might add, actually, one of our vendors here, Leaning Pines, which is right over there against the glass, has a catalog with listing of different plants, and the ones that Jason mentioned are available just right over there for you, and something that you could, something you could take home with you today.
There you go. Wow. Well, we're having a lot of fun here with Jason Fishbach from UW Extension. He's the ag agent for Ashland and Bayfield counties. Don Kissinger, tree guy, urban and community forest coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR. And Tom Casper, he owns Bending Birches Greenhouse near Duluth, Minnesota. Questions for these characters, give us a call at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. We're broadcasting from Bayfield in Bloom here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network as we broadcast from Bayfield in Bloom. I'm Larry Mueller. Wonderful audience here and some great guests to answer your gardening questions. And I hope you'll join in. You know, I always like to make sure we thank some folks for all they do for us, and folks from Wisconsin Public Radio. First, I want to give a big thanks to the Madeline Island Ferry Line. They're doing some work outside, and they've been pile driving just right outside the building for a few days, and they kindly said, hey, you know what, we'll hold back on pile driving during the broadcast. So really appreciate that. And, of course, our Wisconsin Public Radio staff, Paul Danberg, John Talcott, Brittany Williams, Aubrey Ralph, Jane Rotunda, Jill Nadeau, Dave Poltratz, and then, of course, our guests, Jason Fishbach, Don Kassinger, and Tom Casper. Thanks so much for making this a wonderful experience and a great show. And I want to also take some calls as we move along. The number is 800-642-1234. My voice is holding up so far. So let's go to Kathleen and Delavan, who has a question for you guys. Kathleen, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I wish I was up there having more fun than working here in the yards. But my concern is jumping in on the move to plant something like honeyberry, which is from Siberia, Japan, and Asia. So many of our terrifically invasive species are from Asia and Siberia, up around there. And that really needs to be researched before we would allocate large blocks of this and farming of it. We should be planting things like aronia, which is native and has many, many uses, is probably far more nutritious than honeyberries. So just a shout-out to there to really research before you plant or promote anything just because you think it's nice and it would work and taste good.
All right, Kathleen. Comment, Jason, any comment there?
Yeah, it's point well taken. I couldn't agree more, particularly honeyberry. It's in the honeysuckle family, but the process of establishing new crops is evaluating its invasiveness. So how rapidly would it spread? Does it spread? And thankfully, our public land agencies are on top of that and are trying their best to make sure if there are new introductions from outside the country that they're not invasive. It's got to be at the top of the list of everybody to make sure these plants stay out. So it's a point well taken. Yeah. Now, in this case, honeyberry is not invasive, the varieties that are grown.
All right. Thanks again, Kathleen, for that reminder. Jan in Viroqua, will go to you.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I'm trying to figure out how dandelions overwinter. I'm wondering if I cut off the blooms, have I solved the problem, at least in my own garden, until more seed blows in, or are they perennial so they have to dig the plant out?
Joanne, the audience is laughing with you, not at you. What do you think, Tom? Let's go to you.
Yeah, they're a perennial. So, and as most of us have experienced who have dandelions, you go out and mow your lawn and cut off all the tops when you mow it, and the next day it's yellow again. So they're a perennial, Joanne. So if you want to eliminate them, you have to dig that root out or some other form of control, preferably not spraying them if you want to eliminate them. I would encourage you, though, again, as we talk about this problem with butterflies and monarchs, their population and the bee problems, is to celebrate those like we celebrate some of our other flowers in our yard. Bees, and again, very early season bloomers. Some of them are already in bloom. For the early bees, early butterflies, it's a good source of food for them. So rather than this idea that we need to eliminate all those things in our lawn, celebrate it and use it to encourage diversity in our lawn and our landscape.
My brother Dennis made some pretty good dandelion wine.
Exactly.
as a matter of fact. So there you go. Wanda in Orfordville, your turn. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, Larry. You know, I make dandelion jelly. And I found the recipe in a newspaper some years ago. It does taste, as the story tells, tastes like honey. I also make violet jelly, which is a lovely purple color and a lot of fun to make. It changes color as you work on it. So dandelion jelly and violet jelly, I need quite a crock for them.
Wanda, you're going to have to email me. Go to WPR.org/Larry and send me, if you can, shoot some photos of the recipes, and we'll see if we can somehow make those available, because you know what? Dandelion jelly, that sounds pretty good to me. I remember as a kid when you'd always pull those dandelions out and eat the little gold buds that were out. They were always very sweet.
Yeah, life gives you dandelions, you make jelly.
There you go. Thank you, Wanda. Pam in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Pam.
Yes, hi. I was listening to you talk about the vinegar knockouts.
Yeah.
Because I have that snow on the mountain, that stuff that's invasive, and it's throughout all my ground cover. How long do you have to wait to replant after that vinegar?
You can pretty much plant the next day if you wanted to. It's a contact, basically it's similar to a burning it, so you can really plant the next day if you want. Problem is as Jason mentioned, it's going to take the tops off of those things, similar to boiling water. So you're going to want to wait a little while, though, and reapply, especially in a case like snow on the mountain that's very aggressive and very in control. So you're going to want to do several applications before you plant in that, before you do, or else you're just going to be battling that in with your planting. So I would wait a little while, several applications. But really, for folks who are going to use it one time, they can really plant in that garden the following day without any residual impact to those plants. So
there you go, Pam. Thank you. Rob in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Larry. Rob in Green Bay. Quick backfill here of sorts. I'm the guy that had the mantises that were feeding off of a pin, if you remember that story from a while back. But anyway, okay, so what I found as far as controlling stuff growing in your lawn, I like to raise the deck up all the way in the summertime and let the lawn grow tall and go ahead and feed it and whatnot. And eventually, as the lawn starts to thicken up with all of the weeds, the lawn will start choking out a vast majority of the weeds, and you're good to go. I mean, it might take the better part of a season to kind of get control of the weeds, but once you get a good thick lawn like that and keep the deck up high, it starts to choke stuff out. Plus, it hides a multitude of sins if you have a very uneven lawn or whatnot. And then, of course, in the fall, you lower the deck to cut it down for the, you know, upcoming winter season. But it's worked like a charm for me. So that's my two cents.
Well, I tell you what, I would agree with that. Jason, 4 inches, good height? Or
Yep, it's great height.
It's a great height. And if you're like me and you have an electric lawnmower with a cord, the first time I used it, of course, I ran over my cord and put a big... but then I learned my lesson, and frankly, if you keep it up at that 4 inches or higher height, you can run right over your own cord, and it won't and it won't bother. It won't bother at all. Well, I'll tell you what, fun to have with us here today, Jason Fishbach from UW Extension, Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger, the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and Tom Casper, who owns Bending Birches Greenhouses near Duluth, Minnesota. They are our guests today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Today we're broadcasting live from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off the 17th Bayfield in Bloom. Wonderful production. There are lots of things going on in Bayfield. Many, many events. I know, here's one that I'd like to do. The Apple Blossom Run and Ride is on May 25th. That's put on by the Friends of the Bayfield Carnegie Library. There's garden tours and native plant sale. That takes place on June 1st. And then on June 11th, something that I think a lot of people here look forward to, that's the blessing of the fleet. And so another really nice event that I know a lot of people look forward to. And lots of good people here today as we visit with our three guests, Jason Fishbach, UW Extension agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the DNR, and Tom Casper, who owns Bending Birches Greenhouse near Duluth, Minnesota. So always great to have experts here to answer your questions. You can certainly join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Don Kissinger, I want to go back to you because you've already, you had a busy day. You're planting trees and so forth at different locations around the state. And somebody was asking about planting, best tips for planting new trees and shrubs. What should you do and not do?
I think one of the first things you should do is realize what the mature size of this tree is going to be, or shrub or whatever, because you don't want to have it too close to your driveway, your house foundation, that type of stuff, or power lines. That's a big thing. Once you've decided what type of tree you are going to get and you've purchased that, wherever you're going to put it, you want to call, you know, Digger's Hotline, which is just dialing 8111. But as far as the actual installation of the tree, the thing that I see people do incorrectly a lot is planting the trees too deep. And many times, if you look at whether it's, and most residents or most homeowners are going to buy potted trees. I like to get bare root, but the window for planting those is so short. But basically finding where your, well, I'll call it the root flare, trunk collar, because lots of times with trees, there's a little knob, I guess, at the top of the ball, which is actually the bud graft. Many of your trees actually were two trees at one point in time. They have the trunk and then the roots, and that's put together there, and that knob there is artificially high, and you want to go below that and find out where basically kind of the shoulders of the tree or where the roots are and make sure that that's planted at soil line or maybe a little bit higher. And wherever you do plant, you want to make sure that the area is wide enough to be able to encompass all your roots because you don't want them to start circling. So if the tree's planted too deep or the roots start circling, over time they'll girdle the trunk and 5, 8, 10, 11 years down the road, you're going to start to have them, you know, not do well. The other thing is, at planting time, I don't prune any of the limbs, because basically the leaves from the tree are creating the energy for that, and so unless you have a broken limb or a dead limb, I leave that be for a couple of years before you start doing your structural pruning. So those are kind of the biggest tips.
Yeah, those are all good tips as well. Kate in Madison emailed just a different topic here. She's wondering about the toxicity of Kentucky coffee bean pods and locust bean pods. Her kids find these treasures in the neighborhood and play with them. They don't put things in their mouth anymore, but they still want to make sure that these types of pods are okay for them to play with.
I think, you know, and that's what you allude to. Basically, as long as it's not in the mouth, I think you're good to go with that.
But you don't want to be chewing away on them.
No.
Okay. Well, let's see if we got some more questions from the audience or calls. By the way, I haven't given that number again. Let me give it to you right now. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Paulette from Hayward, and I need some information on the best way to protect the trunks of young trees. We have planted a lot of trees, especially fruit trees.
Something that I have used a lot when I used to be a city forester is we would have a lot of drain tile that our streets department would use, and I would take the drain tile, it's 4 inches, 6 inches in diameter, and cut it right up the center and then wrap it around the tree, put it into the soil, and that way, because in working as a city forester and with many communities, using weed whips or string trimmers or lawn mowers, trying to get close to the trunk, they always get too close to the trunk. And that bark at that point in the time is so succulent that can hurt it. Or the meadow mice and voles, as we had this winter. But that's something that I recommend. Also putting using mulch to keep weeds from not growing up there. The one thing I do mention with mulch is you don't want to have it volcano mulch and up against the trunk of the tree. But that's something that will assist, too, in helping to keep those things away from the trunk.
Normally, I would have recommended the plastic spiral wrap, right? And this year, I've found, you know, because if you don't take it off, it starts to expand as the trunk grows. And we've got trees that they've chewed everything that they could get between the spiral wrap. So you've got bark where the spiral wrap was and no bark where it wasn't, right? So now I'm pretty much, you want to use hardware cloth. Make a tube around the trunk of the tree and get that as high as you can. We ran into problems with rabbits because the snow level was so high that they were chewing way up in the tree, and not much you can do about that. So the hardware cloth is more expensive. It's harder to work with, but it's effective, more so than those spiral tree wraps.
And I've seen with the spiral tree wraps where actually if they've been left on too long, they actually can grow into the trunk, and you get this, I guess maybe it's a neat-looking trunk, but I'm actually can somewhat girdle the trunk, too, as well. You get a spiraling in there.
Yeah, that makes sense. We had a handful of people, quite a large handful of people, actually calling in about that vinegar solution for killing weeds. I think, Tom, you brought it up. And they all want to know what's the ratio for dilution. I assume it comes on the vinegar jar itself, but what is it?
It is about, what I've used it at is about 3 to 1, so 3 parts water to 1 part vinegar, and then just a couple of tablespoons of salt, and again making sure the water is warm to hot. When you mix it will make it that much more effective. So mix it up, get the salt into the solution and spray it, and again something you want to use with some sparing. So you don't want to impact too much the salinity or the soil pH too much, but in a moderate application will be just fine. So.
All right. Per gallon or
per gallon?
Per gallon.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
There we go. Well, I think Jill has another audience member for us.
Hello, Peter from Washburn. When I bought my property, it's about 2.5 acres. There were 5. What I assume volunteer apple trees, because even Mr. Erickson can't identify the species. But they're all between 30 and 40 feet tall. And I'm wondering, can I just cut the top 10 feet off? Or how would I get them shorter?
Well, I don't know that you want to cut the top 10 feet off here. There's another way to do it, isn't there, Jason?
Well, so that is an option. but don't do, you know, don't take it from 40 feet to 5 feet. You want it, the kind of rule of thumb is no more than a third of the tree per year. And just start working your way down. Now, you got to think about kind of how it's going to respond, because those are called heading cuts, and the tops of those cuts are just going to profusely sprout the next year, because you're going to have to be ready to follow up with it to keep them down. And eventually what you want to do is, so you've made these heading cuts to get it down, you got to start getting those branches out horizontally. So when you've got those suckers coming off of your heading cuts, about halfway through the growing season, when they're pretty succulent still, you want to tie those down so they're horizontal. And eventually that's going to take the vertical vigor out of that tree and slow down that growth. But it's going to take a number of years to do that. You also want to think about balancing that tree. So if you've got one big branch here, you want to try to make it relatively symmetrical so it's not unbalanced.
One of them has, starting from maybe 15 feet up, branches that do go sideways and actually go all the way to the ground. And every other year, that particular tree produces tons of really good apples, but it's against the pines. So those ones that go all the way to the ground, should I be cutting them up to a certain height?
Yeah, there's no reason you couldn't leave them, but generally those are going to be a couple of problems, right? They're if they're already leaning, they could break and cause damage to the tree. The lower you go, the wetter those leaves stay with morning dew, they're more likely to get the apple scab. So you want to thin that out so you get good airflow. That's going to help on some disease issues as well. And what I'm shocked is the deer haven't eaten all that. But
the deer do. They do some pruning, but they don't do enough. I've got about 15 resident deer, and they come through that portion of the property every evening. And in the winter, you can see where they've been pruning, but there are still branches that reach to the ground.
So apple trees can handle a lot of chainsaw pruning. That's what sounds like is in your future. Up here we still have maybe a week or so, maybe two to do it, but you're starting to get in that window. It's getting to be too late, so it might be a winter project.
The thing, too, when you do cut back that limb, to stop the profusion of growth is if you cut it just above the bud, that will callus a lot better, and that bud will then become a twig, a limb, a leaf, and start growing out, and you are not as likely to get that profusion of all of a sudden six branches where there were one branch before. It's kind of like topping, basically, is what you're doing.
Yeah, there we go.
And I'd like to add that for folks that are thinking about purchasing apple trees or fruit trees, maybe looking for, because of the situation where you've got a 35, 40-foot tall apple tree and 90% of the apples you don't have access to, looking for some of the semi-dwarf or dwarf varieties that are available. So we, as people who want to enjoy those apples, they're more accessible to us. So
I think that's what Larry was getting at. You could do this pretty quickly with one cut.
Yeah.
Right at the base of the tree.
Right at the base of the tree. But it sounds like you've got some good eating apples there, so I can see why you don't want to do that.
Larry, up here at those old apple trees, we don't mess with those old apple trees up here.
Yeah.
Because of the history of these apple trees in Bayfield, and it's culturally, we just try to protect them.
You know what? That's a good thing.
In fact, when the towns clear out the ditches, you know, every spring, the only trees left are all the apple trees left in the ditches. It's just kind of...
That is very cool,
yeah.
Actually. That wonderful. You know, as long as I'm you're on in front of the microphone, Jason, you've been doing a lot of research, and I wanted to bring this up on hazelnuts and growing them as a cash crop in Wisconsin. You recently received a nice federal grant, if I'm not mistaken, to continue that research.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been making some great progress. I wish everything went a lot faster, but these are woody trees that grow slow. So we have, after almost a decade of work, have identified our top varieties, and the availability is still a little, we don't exactly know when, but we're looking at spring 2020. I will say by this fall, we will be starting to take a waiting list so folks can start to sign up for these new varieties. And so the parentage of these are Corliss Americana, which is American hazelnut, which grows wild throughout Bayfield County, Ashland County, and then European hazelnut that grows in Oregon and in the Mediterranean. So you've got the production, the winter hardiness, the disease resistance from our American hazelnut with the larger nut size from the European hazelnut. So stay tuned. Our MidwestHazelnuts.org website is our information portal, and that's where you can find out the latest information.
That is really, really cool. Well, let's take another question from the audience. Again, if you're as you listen in, you want to ask a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234. We had a Heidi in Madison emailed. She lives in an apartment, grows in a community garden. She doesn't get to keep the same plot, so she doesn't know if the people last year took care of the plot. It's also in an area with clay soil. What are some tips to make the soil a little better before she plants? And, she every year she doesn't quite know where she's going to be. Tom, it's good to go to you.
And that certainly is a challenge for anybody who's doing a community garden, that are putting that time into improving their soil and getting the weeds out and making it ready for the garden. So certainly if she's dealing with clay soils or things like that, bringing compost in is really the best thing that we can do. And really even those of us that have been gardening for years, adding either creating your own compost pile and reusing those things that your garden is producing back into our soil to improve it, or getting compost from one of the local municipalities that produce it is really the single best and fastest thing we can do to improve our soil and to get it ready for our plants to enjoy. So
that's great. I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but with my straw bales at the end of the year, by the next spring, there's a bunch left over. I just pile them all up, and then I take my sea potatoes and I just kind of throw them in like Ruth Stout used to do. If you want to see something really cool, I'll go online to Ruth Stout's garden.
Larry, if I can, I just want to mention, so composting at the garden scale, right, those that do it, you realize how little you actually get from your compost pile. We have an amazing resource here in Ashland with the Northland College. They have a commercial composting facility in a program where they collect food scraps and they collect sawdust from local sawmills and leaves. And so this is a full-blown compost facility, so they get the right temperatures that kill the weeds. They're really careful about what goes in it, and they make that compost available to the community. I believe they sell it. But that's, if anyone's interested, just contact the Northland College Food Center, and you can get access to that compost. Because as we know, it's hard to find good compost, and boy, once you have it, it changes everything in your garden once you've got good compost.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a wonderful service for this area. Jill has latched on to another audience member here, so let's go.
Welcome back to Bayfield. I'm Mary from Delta in our beautiful Shawamigan Forest, in the shade of the beautiful Shawamigan Forest. But imagine my surprise this morning in my perennial garden, a hummingbird. So, looking very confused as it hovered above the snow. So I'm wondering, what sort of plant could I buy, or a hanging plant or something that I could put out for this hummingbird so early in our season up here?
Yeah, Tom?
Any that are blooming right now. and probably getting a feeder out, and you don't need to use the red dye that folks have used, just sugar and water. Bringing the water to a boil, adding sugar to it, probably 1-to-1 ratio, and then putting it in those feeders would really be the best thing right now till there's lots of flower choices. But if you get to one of the greenhouses, whether it's Hauser's or some of the other folks, something that it's in bloom, trumpet-shaped flowers, if you can, petunias or if-to vine, stuff like that will work really well right now if they're in bloom. But anything in bloom that has the right shape flower will help them. So,
yeah, and on a quick thing like this, the hummingbird feeders probably is a good idea if you want to get something out there right away that they're going to, that bird's going to go right to. I think that's probably a very good piece of advice. I had my Baltimore Orioles come. They were a day late this year. I was kind of disappointed. always come on May 4th, and here they didn't come till May 5th. What a terrible thing. And it was fun to have the oranges out and the jelly and so forth. Well, let's take another question from the audience here. And yes.
I'd just like to ask the panel, if a homeowner wants to eliminate their lawn, they don't want the image of an English estate anymore, what's the best way to eliminate their lawn?
All right. Jason, you want to start?
Well, it depends how fast you want to do it, but one option is just to smother it and put down thick plastic or whatever you can find, cardboard, but that probably doesn't look so good. So, and that it won't take very long. If it's just, you know, Kentucky bluegrass or something, it doesn't have rhizomes, it'll only just take a couple of weeks, and it should be able to kill it. You could try solarizing it, which is using white plastic or clear plastic so the sun gets through and basically burns it up. Or, as Thomas talked about, this acetic acid burn down the vinegar can contact and kill it as well. Or, you know, lawn isn't that hard to just till it up, dig it up and hoe it up, and it'll be dead with a little bit of drying. So it's not that hard to do, luckily.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We will, boy, here we are. I'm looking at my clock here. We're kind of running out of time a little bit. Just a reminder, if you are looking for a place to go visit, I would highly recommend visiting Bayfield and Washburn and the areas up here in northern Wisconsin. It's always a beautiful time of the year, spring. They did have a little snow, but guess what? That snow's mostly gone except up on the high hills. There's lots of event. I talked about the Apple Blossom Run and Ride on May 25th, but the garden tour and native plant sales, they get going on June 1st is the first of that, and I know there are many to follow up, and there are lots of good folks here to help you get going with your garden. And I've already purchased some plants here today, which I will be taking back to Madison, and looking forward to having them out for my little birthday celebration tomorrow afternoon, when we've got 40 or so people coming to my house. Thanks so much I mentioned some of the folks, but Jason, our guest today, Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent from Ashland and Bayfield Counties, Don Kissinger. These guys have been coming for a long time. Don's the Urban and Community Forest Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and Tom Casper is a first, and hopefully we may have a chance to talk with him again. He's the owner of Bending Birches Greenhouse near Duluth, Minnesota, and a wonderful audience here. Thank you all so much for being with us today. It's really a pleasure, and thank you so much for listening in today. Monday, we'll take a look at fossil formations in Milwaukee. We cover everything here on this show, and we always have a lot of fun. Thanks again for being with us.